Welcome back to The Faith Explained. This is Cale Clark, your host. Glad that you're with me. We're going through the plagues that God is raining down on the Egyptians in the book of Exodus. So why don't we open our Bibles up to Exodus chapter 7, just the end of chapter 7, the beginning of chapter 8. And just to set us up where we were before, we talked about how God turned the Nile into blood. And again, this is the confrontation between gods, between the one true and living God, Yahweh, the God of Israel, and the false gods of the Egyptians. Now, who are these gods? It could be demons in disguise. As the Old Testament says, the gods of the Gentiles are demons in one particular place. And that could be the case. Either they're non-existent or they might be demons in disguise. But we do know this, that to the Egyptians, the Nile River was considered to be godlike, considered to be divine, the God happy. H-A-P-I was really the Nile personified. And yes, people were happy when the Nile flooded every year, would water the crops, provide food for the people. And of course, that leads to life. There's also, of course, the Egyptian god Osiris, who was considered to be the father, the godfather, if you will, of the Pharaoh. Not that his father really was a god in real life, but very often leaders will say this. Ancient kings would say this, that they were the spawn of a god. And so really turning the Nile into blood is a direct full frontal attack on these false Egyptian gods. And so Pharaoh, as we saw before, he doesn't really care about this so much. He just goes into his palace and says whatever, shrugs his shoulders, and he does not repent. He does not let the people go. Now we're going to get into the last of the water plagues. The first three plagues have to do with water. The first one, of course, was Aaron's staff, which turned into the sea monster and swallowed up the other the staffs of the Egyptian magicians. They were able to kind of replicate this, turn their staffs into sea monsters as well. But Aaron's ate them and had a nice meal. Maybe took a nap afterwards. I don't know. But there's, of course, the staff turning into the sea monster. And then, of course, there's the Nile being turned into blood. And now we have the last of the water plagues, and that is the plague of frogs. So let's look at the very, very last verse of chapter 7 in the book of Exodus, which is verse 25. And then it kind of leads right into chapter 8, verse 1 and following. So let's read it together. It says, 7 days passed after the Lord had struck the Nile. Then the Lord said to Moses, go into Pharaoh and say to him, thus says the Lord, let my people go, that they may serve me. But if you refuse to let them go, behold, I will plague all your country with frogs. The Nile shall swarm with frogs, which shall come up into your house and into your bedchamber and on your bed and into the houses of your servants and of your people and into your ovens and into your kneading bowls. The frogs shall come up on you and your people and on all your servants. And the Lord said to Moses, say to Aaron, stretch out your hand with your rod over the rivers, over the canals, and over the pools, and cause frogs to come upon the land of Egypt. So Aaron stretched out his hand over the waters of Egypt, and the frogs came up and covered the land of Egypt. But the magicians did the same by their secret arts and brought frogs upon the land of Egypt. Then Pharaoh called Moses and Aaron and said, entreat the Lord to take away the frogs from me and from my people, and I will let the people go to sacrifice to the Lord. Moses said to Pharaoh, be pleased to command me when I am to entreat for you and for your servants and for your people, that the frogs be destroyed from you and your houses and be left only in the Nile. And he said, tomorrow. And that's Pharaoh saying, tomorrow. Moses said, be it as you say, that you may know that there is no one like the Lord our God. The frogs shall depart from you and your houses and your servants and your people. They shall be left only in the Nile. So Moses and Aaron went out from Pharaoh, and Moses cried to the Lord concerning the frogs as he had agreed with Pharaoh. And the Lord did according to the word of Moses. The frogs died out of the houses and the courtyards and out of the fields. And they gathered them together in heaps, and the land stank. But when Pharaoh saw that there was a respite, he hardened his heart and would not listen to them, as the Lord had said. Okay, so let's stop there for just a moment and talk about this plague of frogs. Okay, so this is kind of an interesting section here. God is going to give instruction on how this plague is going to come about. It happens. And then there's this kind of extended discussion of Pharaoh's response here, which is quite intriguing for several reasons. And so Pharaoh's essentially going to lie to Moses' face. And this is different from the plague of the Nile being turned into blood. Now, that one he could kind of walk away from. That one he could sort of turn his back on, but not this time. Not this time, because the frogs come up out of the Nile, and they are all over the land. They get into Pharaoh's home. They're into his palace. They get into even his chambers, his bedroom, and even, yes, on his marriage bed. We're going to talk about the significance of that in just a moment. But he essentially lies to Moses and says, pray for me, entreat Yahweh for me, that this would go away. And I promise, I'll let the people go. And of course, he doesn't do it. He doesn't listen. And this is exactly what God has been saying all along. He is not going to listen. He's going to be hardening his heart again and again and again. That's what it says in the last little verse here, this section of verse 15 of chapter 8. When Pharaoh saw that there was a respite, that the frogs had died off, he hardened his heart and would not listen to them, to Moses and Aaron, as the Lord had said. So again, part of the deal here with these plagues, it's not just to remind the Israelites of the power of Yahweh, getting them out of slavery in Egypt, but Pharaoh, God has been saying all along, Pharaoh will know that I am the Lord, but he's not at that point right yet. However, there has been some progress here. He's taking God seriously now. He never did before. He's taking Yahweh seriously. Remember back in chapter 5, when Moses first approached Pharaoh and said, let my people go. And he said, who is Yahweh? Who is this God? He's nothing to me. He's a slave God of a slave people. He's nothing. He's a nobody. But now he's saying to Moses, all right, please pray. Entreat the Lord. Pray for me. Take away these frogs from me and my people, and I will let your people go to sacrifice to the Lord. So at least he's taking Yahweh seriously. So he's progressing here in his recognition of how powerful God is, but he's not quite all the way home yet. Now, there's a seven-day period. We see this at the beginning of the section here. 7 days have passed between the Nile being turned into blood and the frogs coming up out of the Nile River. And this has to do, as Dozman says, this has to do with defilement. Because when you read the Old Testament, there's various ways that you can be unclean. And there's often this seven-day period that has to pass before you're considered clean again, before you're considered undefiled, and you can participate once again in the worship of God. And often that has to do with blood. One good example of this is in the book of Numbers, chapter 19. And it says this, he who gathers the ashes of the heifer shall wash his clothes and be unclean until evening. And this shall be to the sons of Israel and to the stranger who sojourns among them a perpetual statute. Listen to this. Now, this has to do with dead bodies. He who touches the dead body of any person shall be unclean 7 days. He shall cleanse himself with the water on the third day and on the seventh day and so be clean. But if he does not cleanse himself on the third day and on the seventh day, he will not become clean. Whoever touches a dead person, the body of any man who has died, and does not cleanse himself, defiles the tabernacle of the Lord, and that person shall be cut off from Israel, because the water for impurity was not thrown upon him. He shall be unclean, his uncleanness is still on him. And that's one of the reasons, by the way, when Jesus tells the parable of the Good Samaritan, that's why the priest walks by the guy on the other side of the road, because he thinks this guy might be dead. I don't want to help him. I don't know if he's alive or not, but if I do touch him and he's dead, then guess what? I'll be considered ritually unclean, and I can't fulfill my duties as a priest. Selfish move, to be sure. God cares much more about this person's life than about your inconveniences and the fact that you're going to have to, take a little break before you can get back to your duties. The point of this is that there is ritual and uncleanness here because of the blood of the Nile. And so 7 days afterwards, what does God say? Now you can approach Pharaoh with this message. Now, of course, these things kind of go away in the New Covenant to almost an entire extent here, but this was part of the deal in the Old Covenant times. And this is why these lepers, another thing, if somebody had leprosy, they were to cry out, unclean, unclean, before approaching someone so that you didn't defile yourself. You couldn't participate in the religious life of Israel if you were unclean. And Jesus, of course, reaches out and touches this leper in Mark's gospel. It's narrated in some other gospels as well, but Jesus touches the man, says, I am willing, you will be made clean. You don't defile me by touching me. I am purity. I have the power to heal. You can't do anything to me, but I can do something to you. I can cleanse you. And Jesus wants to reach out and touch us as well, cleanse us of our sins. So anyways, let's get back to Yahweh here, who says to Moses to go to Pharaoh with this message. I'm going to give him another message. Thus says Yahweh. All right, if you're not listening now, if you haven't been listening up to this point, Pharaoh, hopefully you will now. You're listening to The Faith Explained on Relevant Radio. I'm your host, Cale Clark. And so what does he say to him? He says, say to him, let my people go that they may serve me. If you refuse to let them go, I will plague all your country with frogs. The Nile shall swarm with frogs, which shall come up into your house and into your bedchamber, and on your bed and into the houses of your servants and of your people, into your ovens and your kneading bowls. And they're going to get into everything, the food. Man, so you're frog cookies, I guess. I don't know, but this is not a good scene at all. And this is really, there's a theological point here as well. So Psalm 104, this is intriguing. Dozman mentions this. Psalm 104, a lot of scholars actually think that Psalm 104 was something the Israelites picked up from the Egyptians. Now, if you read Psalm 104, it talks about God almost like an architect over creation. He talks about stretching out the heavens like a tent, laying the beams of your chambers upon the waters. It goes on to say, setting the earth on its foundations, that it should never be shaken. So some people think that the Israelites actually kind of borrowed this from the Egyptians. It was very similar to an ancient hymn of the Egyptians, the hymn of one of the pharaohs, Amenhotep IV. Amenhotep IV. And so what is this all about? It's basically the Israelites saying, okay, this was a hymn that the Egyptians had about creation, but they didn't really understand who the one true and living God was who created all things. So they took what was pagan and they made it holy. And that's what God does with each one of us as well. When we're baptized, he takes what's essentially pagan and makes it holy. He brings us into his family, into his people. And so in Psalm 104, it talks about Yahweh kind of as the divine architect, stretching out the heavens like a tent, setting the mountains on foundations, as I just read to you. And here's the thing. There's a boundary set up between the water and the land. You can't cross it. It mentions this in Psalm 104, verse 9. It says, you set a boundary which they should not pass so that they might not again cover the earth. It's talking about the waters of the flood. As we read about in the Genesis series, in the book of Genesis on The Faith Explained, we studied that, how God sent this flood to punish this sinful world and wipe out the creation, start over again. And so the fact that the water, something from the water is coming up onto the land, in other words, the frogs, essentially what's going on here is that creation is starting to break down. Creation is starting to break down. We're going to see this later on when it comes to more plagues which come from the air, like the locusts. The locusts are going to come from the air onto the land. Now we have the frogs coming from the water onto the land. So creation is breaking down. Why is this happening? It's because Pharaoh has defiled the land by enslaving the Israelites, by killing the firstborn. He has shed innocent blood. He has defiled the land. and the very creation is starting to break down, to cry out against him. And so that's part of the deal. But also, again, we have to ask the question, why in particular frogs? God could have sent any kind of creature out of the sea, but he sent the frogs. Well, there's a religious reason for this. There's an absolute religious reason for this. Well, first of all, to the Jews, frogs were unclean animals. So it's again, another judgment upon Pharaoh and the Egyptians. But especially when you think about them getting into the cooking, into the food bowls and everything, and now you don't want that. But you're not exactly eating, you know, deep fried frog legs in Israel. It's not kosher at all. However, there's a religious angle to this too. And Dozman reports this, that there's an Egyptian goddess. They had this pantheon of false gods, and they had a goddess called Heket. And she was portrayed as having the head of a frog. And what's more, this goddess Heket was all about life in ancient Egypt. And in fact, she would kind of team up with another god named Khnum, and they would sort of team up and facilitate the birth of human children. So this is why the frogs get into not only Pharaoh's palace, they get up into his bedroom and even into his marriage bed. So this goddess was sort of seen as a goddess of life, if you will. They had a lot of gods. There was another god named Bes, B-E-S. He was considered the god of the bedroom, if you will. Marital relations had to do with fertility, protecting the family, was thought to protect the family, especially at night, and protect children as they're being born. So these Egyptian gods, quote unquote, small g gods, are under attack by Yahweh. So again, this is a religious statement. All of the plagues are attacking false gods in the Egyptian pantheon. And one more thing too, there might be a hint of the ultimate plague that will come, the final plague, the death of the Egyptian firstborn. Just as Pharaoh once sought to kill the firstborn males of the Israelites, of course, God is going to slay the firstborn children of the Egyptians because Pharaoh would not listen. So again, these false gods thought to protect the children. Could there be a hint of that here? Well, Dozman thinks so, and he might be right about that. The bottom line is Pharaoh doesn't quite get it yet. That not only is Yahweh powerful, he's starting to see that, but there is no God like Yahweh. In fact, he is the one true and living God. Okay, so God has gotten Pharaoh's attention. He can't run away from this. And this leads him to have this conversation with Moses. He's trying to get out of this particular plague, this particular problem. And he asks Moses to pray to God for him. That's incredible. Considering where he was before, how he just, you know, completely dismissed Yahweh. This is a great admission on Pharaoh's part. And also, as Dozman says, this is sort of the beginnings of Moses being the great intercessor, not only for Pharaoh in this case, even for his enemy, but also for the people of God. He will pray later on that Israel is not destroyed when they go back to worshiping these gods of Egypt, the golden calf. We'll talk about that later. So he promises, he says, okay, pray for me, pray that these frogs get sent away, and I promise, I'll let your people go, you can go worship in the wilderness. He's lying. He's a total hypocrite. Now we know this. He's full of deceit. We've known this from the beginning of the book of Exodus. And what's interesting too is that Moses says, well, he leaves it all in Pharaoh's court. He leaves the ball in Pharaoh's court. When do you want me to pray for you? When do you want me to pray about this? And Pharaoh says, how about tomorrow? Okay, all right, no problem. So it's all in his court. God has not taken away his freedom, and he has something to do with whether or not he's going to be saved. And the same is true for us. As St. Augustine says, the God who created you without you will not save you without you. We have to use our human freedom to open the door to God and accept his divine mercy, his salvation, his forgiveness, in and through Jesus Christ. We'll have much more on the book of Exodus in the next episode of The Faith Explained, but for now, gotta open up once again the Faith Explained mailbag for you. All right, our first question comes to us from David, who's listening on the Spotify app in San Diego. And by the way, if you have a question for the Faith Explained mailbag too of your own, you can email it to me. Faith is the address, faith@relevantradio.com. And you can also find me on Twitter. Follow me there at Cale Clark, C-A-L-E, Clark with an E. We also have a Faith Explained account as well, at Faith Explained, and you can get your question to us via Twitter. And David's question is this. Hi, Cale. Did Muhammad, the founder of Islam, do miracles like Jesus? That is a good question, and the answer is no. And in fact, Muhammad was very clear that he did not do any miracles. Of course, he is viewed as a prophet within Islam. Islam teaches that Jesus is a prophet. Of course, we know that he is much more than that. And I think an interesting sidebar discussion that we could have maybe another time is about the early history of Islam. Some people, some scholars even say that Islam is actually a Christian heresy. Why do they say that? Because it incorporates elements of Christianity, elements of Judaism, and also elements of Arabic culture. Of course, Islam did not get going until the 6th century AD, and Muhammad had actually met some Nestorian Christians who were in fact themselves heretics. They didn't have the right story about Jesus Christ, so it's possible that he never met an Orthodox Christian in his life. Anyways, we'll have to bracket that off for another time. But in terms of the question, we've seen this in Exodus. Very often, miracles are kind of a calling card for the true message of a prophet. Let's look at what we've seen here already in Exodus. Of course, we have Moses being told by God, hey, throw your staff onto the ground. It turns into a snake, turns into the Nahash. And then God says, all right, well, you know, put your hand in your cloak, pull it out, it'll be leprous, do it again, it'll be healed. And then, of course, turning the Nile into blood. And this is proof, right? This is what God says in the book of Exodus. This is so that they may believe, the Egyptians may believe, that the Lord, the God of their fathers, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob, has appeared to you. Now, this is, again, very common in the Old Testament times, that miracles would be the calling card of a prophet really coming from God. Think about the prophet Elijah in his duel with the false prophets of Baal, one of the false gods that the Israelites had to fight against. And this is what happened. You can read about that in 1 Kings chapter 18. Of course, God sends a fire from heaven to consume the sacrifice. And even in the case of Jesus, in John's gospel, Nicodemus, one of the scribes, the teachers of the Jews, comes to Jesus at night, Nick at night, I guess you could say. And he says to Jesus, Rabbi, we know you are a teacher who has come from God, for no one could perform the miraculous signs you are doing if God were not with him. And of course, throughout John's gospel, the miracles of Jesus are seen as signs. They're supposed to point somewhere. They're supposed to point to something, the divinity of Christ. And we also see in John's gospel the famous I am statements, where Jesus takes this divine name that God revealed to Moses unto himself. I am the way, the truth, and the life. I am the door. I am the good shepherd. There's so many. I am the resurrection and the life. There's so many instances of that. Now, with respect to Muhammad, even in the Quran, it says that when unbelievers challenged him to perform a miracle, he didn't do it. He told them, hey, go read a chapter in the Quran. Muhammad said, according to the Quran, God has power to send down a sign. They will say, why is not a sign sent down to him from his Lord? And he did not do any miracles or anything like that. And about 200 years after he died, some of his followers started to create or invent miracles surrounding his life. But no, Muhammad, the founder of Islam, did not do miracles, didn't claim to do miracles. And by the way, I do not at all mean to imply that Islam is divinely inspired. Not at all. Again, I think what happened here, one explanation, there are other explanations as well, but one explanation is that Muhammad picked up some things from Christians, from Judaism, and also from Arabic cultures and kind of mashed it together at some level. That's one explanation. There are others too, like I said, but this does beg another question about other religions of the world. A lot of people say, don't they all teach the same thing at the end of the day? And I remember once seeing a poster in a Catholic school that seemed to imply that all religions are in fact equal. There are many ways up the mountain, many paths up the mountain. It was all about the golden rule. It was all about how the golden rule apparently exists in all religions. Now, Jesus's version is much more challenging because he says, do unto others as you would want them to have done unto you. It's much more open-ended, whereas most versions of the golden rule say, don't do to other people what you don't want them to do to you. The truth of the matter is that all religions think they are correct. Each major world religion thinks it is the only way. You better believe that the adherents of Islam think that theirs is the only way. We Catholics very humbly say that our church was in fact founded by God himself, the God-man. So Buddhism, think about Buddhism. It doesn't even claim that there is a God. One of the most respected Hindu philosophers said that theism, believing in God, is only a child's path to get to the top of the mountain, where you find out, what do you find out in the end? That God is the same as you, not distinct from you at all. So it's not true in any way, shape, or form that all religions teach the same thing. They're all mutually exclusive religions, and they all cannot be true at the same time. Truth is singular, as always. And for us, truth is a person, the person of Jesus Christ, who says, I am the way, the truth, and the life, and no one comes to the Father except through me. If anyone is in heaven, it's because of Jesus Christ, and they know that. And so we could talk about this till the cows come home, but I think we've got to leave it there. If you have a question for me, you can also email me, just as David did, faith@relevantradio.com is the address. We'll try to get to it. You can also find me on Twitter @CaleClark, C-A-L-E, Clark with an E. We'll see you on the next episode of The Faith Explained right here on Relevant Radio.